My name is Sotan, and I'm a senior student here, for those of you who don't know me. And I want to start by giving a shout out to the William H. Hall High School class of 1977, whose reunion I attended, the 40th reunion I attended last night, and then hurried back here by train. It will inform some of what we're going to talk about. And one of the surprises at the reunion for me is how many people at the reunion, at my high school classmates, listened to my things online and were coming and talking to me about it. And so to all of you classmates of mine who are listening to this, this one's for you. it's a very strange weekend, as you can imagine. I've never been to a high school reunion before. But I thought the 50th would be too depressing. I better do it now. I wanted to talk about the koan from the Blue Cliff Record, number 97, which is the title of which in the edition I'm using is The Diamond Cutter Scripture's Scornful Revilement. What they refer to as the Diamond Cutter Scripture, we often refer to simply as the Diamond Sutra. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. The koan. The Diamond Cutter Scripture says, if one is scornfully reviled by others, so imagine this, just with that phrase in the context of a high school reunion. If one is scornfully reviled by others, this person has done wicked acts in previous ages, which should bring them down into evil ways. But because of the scorn and vilification by others in the present age, the wicked action of former ages is thereby extinguished. Whoa. So first, the Diamond Sutra. The title, the word that is typically translated as diamond is the word vajra, which can mean diamond, like a very, very sharp gem that is capable of cutting anything, or a thunderbolt. In the Tibetan iconography, it's often a double thunderbolt. The double Dorje is a version of this. And either way, it's something that cuts through, utterly through delusion, to get through to the ultimate reality that underlies our illusions about the nature of reality. The earliest copy of the complete printed book was found in the Dunhuang Caves in China and dates to 868. It's actually dated. And so predates Gutenberg as a printed, complete printed book by about 600 years. So when we revisit European centrist views of history as part of this, think about that. But its history goes further back, obviously, and there are fragments of texts through various languages and various translations. And throughout Chan Buddhism in China, this was a real central key text with hundreds of commentaries written about it and teachers traveling the countryside, giving lectures about it from their own perspectives with their own commentaries. And one of the, a focus of the commentary in the Blue Cliff Record is the Diamond Sutra itself says that if you recite the Diamond Sutra, even four verses of it, just the recitation alone will be that vajra that will cut through delusion, that will bring you face to face with ultimate reality. Just the fact of the sutra itself. Which reading about that reminds me of a really delightful story from The Hidden Lamp, the collection that our teachers have collaborated in, stories from 25 centuries of awakened women. And this one is about a young woman named Satsujo in Japan. And So I'm quoting from the book, the way it's written there. A devout layman took his young daughter, Satsujo, with him whenever he visited Master Hakuin, who was a Zen master in the 18th century and part of our lineage. Though only a child, she was devoted to practicing the Dharma. When she was 16, her parents were concerned that she would not find a husband and asked her to pray to Kannon, the Bodhisattva of compassion. She did this day and night during all of her activities. Before long, she experienced a deep awakening. One day, her father peeked into her room and saw her sitting on a copy of the Lotus Sutra. "What are you doing, sitting on the precious scripture?" he shouted. And she replied, "How is this wonderful sutra different from my ass?" The Diamond Sutra, oh my God. And the commentary says, what, if you placed it in a room, it would radiate light? Without just merely existing, and so one step further, merely to recite it is sufficient to cut through your delusions. So it raises that question over and over again. And the commentary quotes actually another story, Layman Pang, who is a 9th century, 8th to 9th century Chinese itinerant teacher who, listening to a scholar, so one of these hundreds of scholars wandering the country reciting, talking about their commentaries and demonstrating how smart they are, like I'm trying to do this morning, this scholar is expounding the text, and Layman Pang gets his attention. A layman dares to have a small question. Is that all right? And the lecturer says, if you have a doubt, please ask. And Layman Pang says, there is no sign of self, no sign of others, which is Diamond Sutra stuff. So who are you to have lecture, and who would you have listen? The lecturer said, I just interpret the meaning of this. The layman then said in verse, no self and no others. How could there be near or far? I urge you to stop going to lectures. How could that be compared to seeking the real directly? The nature of diamond wisdom is devoid of a single particle of doubt. I have heard through I faithfully accept are all just artificial names. So this Dharma talk from here on is really essentially bullshit. But I'm going to try and lead you slightly in my way to have a little bit of an experience of something a little further down. So let's get to the text itself. Whoops. So one performs wicked acts in earlier lives that should bring them down into evil today. Actually, let me read the whole thing again. If one is scornfully reviled by others, this person has done wicked acts in previous ages which should bring them down into evil ways. But because of the scorn and vilification by others in the present age, the wicked action of former ages is thereby extinguished. So we've got a statement basically of some sort of karmic outcome. If you're doing wicked acts, the karmic outcome down the line, ages hence, lifetimes hence, is going to be scorn and vilification by other people. And this, to me, sets up, and that in turn extinguishes your prior wickedness. So this sets up a couple of problems and dilemmas for me as a modern reader. First off, it smacks a little bit of tit for tat, eye for eye sort of thing that a lot of us are running from in Buddhist practice because that's maybe uncomfortable in Jewish and Christian practice. And we sort of deal with that in a very superficial cultural way in Zen practice by sort of spreading it out over many lifetimes. The problem of, well, good things should happen to good people, bad things should happen to bad people, that's karma, right? And that's the way people will use the word in our culture commonly now. And we go, no, 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 that's not what it means. I mean, you know, you see a good person now and they're suffering. Well, maybe in a past life, you know, this is reaping the rewards of something they did earlier. But is that really helping the situation? Isn't it still, you know, if it's just because you're spreading it out over multiple lives, it's still good for good, bad for bad. You're just sort of stretching it out thinly over ages. So that's one issue. But the other issue is, it seems kind of interesting, scornful revilement, which is a horrible thing to be subjected to, and we'll discuss that a little bit more, it sounds like it's actually skillful medicine. It's chemotherapy for your wicked deeds in the past. Because it not only pays you back, but it extinguishes the implications of your past wicked deeds. And when you've got cancer, you accept, okay, chemotherapy is going to be horrible. Okay, I did something in my past life, and now I am subject to scornful revilement. that's okay. It's medicine. So, which is kind of nice. We've got an out. Oh, it's taken care of. But it's still, it strikes me as odd in a more complex way, which I'll get to shortly. But first I wanted to go into, well, what do we mean by scornful revilement? And I think if we say the phrase in this month, in this year, in this country, it's exceptionally vivid. We have a government that rode into power on a flood wave of scornful revilement, of immigrants, of Muslims, of LGBTQ people, of people of color, and that's potentiating an eruption of scornful revilement throughout the country. And so I think the minute I read that phrase, all I could see was you-know-who and all the minions surrounding him. But then, being a Zen student and being a liberal New Yorker, I have to go, well, but here I am scornfully reviling all the people who scornfully revile me and my kind. And then look at that and go, no, okay, there's no moral equivalence between the oppressor scornfully reviling the oppressed compared to the oppressed scornfully reviling those who are doing the oppressing. There is no moral equivalence. But at the same time, having the feeling of scornful revilement, projecting that outwards, is a corrosive experience, regardless of whether it's a terrible thing or an appropriate response. And, you know, this is the kind of issue raised, certainly, obviously, you know, the obvious figures, Gandhi, King, etc., but many others, and particularly in our Zen tradition, though not always in our Zen tradition, but the idea that that experience is so corrosive, there has to be an alternate way. And we typically in our culture refer to this encapsulated as the idea of nonviolence. And that's a response to this, I think. But in the context of going to your high school reunion, so I knew I was going to talk about this koan a couple of weeks ago. I thought this would be a good one. And I was riding on my bicycle to work, pondering it. And this blonde-haired, blue-eyed American waspy jock boy came up on his bicycle and rode by me. And I watched in wonder as he sped along. I'm on my heavy city bike, so going comparatively slowly, and he's on his speed bike, racer, and a road bike. And I had this pang. And I know that pang really, really well, because when I was growing up, a nice nerdy Jewish boy, first generation of American, of immigrant parents, in WASPy New England, and a cousin had given me the complete set of the Hardy Boy books, 63 volumes, which I was obsessive about my reading, so if I owned a book, I had to read it. So I read all of these, and somewhere in there, I was like, why can't I be a Hardy Boy? And actually, years later, when my husband met me for the first time, I remember very clearly I was wearing khaki pants, cordovan loafers, no socks, a blue button-down shirt, Oxford shirt with a pink cotton cable sweater and wire-framed glasses and a bad haircut. And fortunately, I met him because about 6 days later, I was wearing all black, and being the late 80s, it was all oversized, and I looked completely different. And my father saw me a few days after that, and he said, "Who died?" I thought, "I did." So what was that? You know, it wasn't me scornfully reviling my neighbors, and I wasn't receiving scornful revilement from them, but I had this cultural sense, wherever it arose from, that I was not what I wanted to be, or what I should be, or what was the best thing to be. And I reviled myself. And of course, tied up in that was growing up gay and being totally messed up about that. And I certainly reviled myself about that. In West Hartford, we had a Protestant area of town, which was the oldest part, a Catholic part of town, and a Jewish part of town. And the Jewish part of town was the newest, and all the streets were named after Indian tribes. And there was Mohawk and Mohegan and King Philip and Sequoia, and, you know. And that was referred to by everyone else as the reservation. And the Catholics all lived in Little Vatican City. And there were three hospitals, and there were three country clubs, there were three shopping centers. And if I tread into the wrong area, there's a reasonable chance I was going to get beaten up. And so some of my trepidation going back to the reunion was that sense of fear I grew up in, of, oh, there were boundaries, and if I crossed them, there might even be physical violence. And then I got to the reunion, and it was actually amazingly delightful. Having the Dharma talk on Sunday almost gave me the option to not go. And then I thought, no, the fact that I'm resisting this and diving for the easy out means, no, I should go. This will. And people were really sweet. And but over and over again, there were reflections of this idea of comparing people to their past selves, comparing themselves to each other as they were then, comparing themselves to each other as they are now. And so many comments, particularly because, like I said, a number of people were following my talks and stuff online, had this sense of me at, well, I hang out with Deepak Chopra. So I'm hanging out with famous people. So I've accomplished something. And then there's another member of the class who far and away exceeds everyone else in terms of amassed wealth. And someone actually said to me, "Who's more accomplished in the class, you or him? Who's the most accomplished? Is it you or him?" And then she told me what she was doing, and she had a child at 45 years old, and she's now 58, as we all are, and in that group. So her daughter's 13, and she was telling me about raising her child. And I was like, maybe you're the most accomplished person in the class. And she really was resistant to hearing that. She kept sort of pulling back from it. There were several women in the class who have children with chronic illnesses and whose lives have become about managing the care of these, and they're extraordinary. And I was pleased to see they weren't playing that game with themselves. They were acknowledging, no, I'm accomplishing something by doing this. And some of them have made that their life's work outside of their own child. That was a surprisingly common theme. But this idea of scornful revilement, you know, the koan is explicit. It's scornful revilement by others. But it's a game we all play, to one extent or another, have at some point in our lives. And today in this country, it's obviously an essential key issue. The thing about it, wherever it's arising, it's drawing boundaries between self and other. And that's something I will address in a moment. First, I want to bring out a demonstration device. I asked Roshi for permission. Can I use something? And she's like, yeah, whatever. So the weird implication of this karmic loop is you perform a wicked deed, and several lives later, you are scornfully reviled, and that extinguishes your wicked deeds. But now the people who are scornfully reviling you are creating wicked deeds. And so in future lives, they're going to have to, et cetera. And so there's this weird looping. Now you can think of a loop in at least two different ways. This is a piece of paper. For those listening to this as a podcast, if you don't know what a Mobius strip is, M as in Mary, O, B as in boy, I, U, S, Google it for the picture. So you can take a strip of paper and connect it like this, like you're gonna make a chain. It's just a single loop. And you have two sides to it. And there's the outer side and the inner side, and they are separate. And you've heard me talk about things in, many of you have heard me talk about things in past talks in terms of complementarity. And I'll go into that a little bit more deeply. So you could think that this is sort of the scornful revilement wicked deed loop. The problem is that on the other side, there are no wicked deeds and there is no scornful revilement. It's all on one side. And that's really not the model we have. What the text is suggesting is a Mobius strip, where if you twist where you would join the strip of paper and you twist it around, instead of having two sides now, you in fact, though it's three dimensions, it only has one side. And if you travel around it, you cover what would have been two sides in the simple form is now one single side. So there's this self-propulsive sort of nature to this. You start with the wicked deed, it becomes scornful revilement, it extinguishes the wicked deed, which leads to more scornful revilement, and no matter where you go, you're always on the same track. And so it's like, is scornful revilement and wicked deeds built into the structure of existence? Which is a horrible thought, but isn't that the first noble truth? Just a specific version of it. Life is suffering, life is anguish. And there's no getting around that, except we have the rest of the noble truth. There is a way around it. And that's where I think the concept of complementarity starts to become useful. The way I've spoken about it before. So, to review, at this level of scale, we are all selves and others sitting here in a room, and there are distinct boundaries, and we stop at our skin. But we know that if you go down to the cellular level, then you're just a flock of cells that are self-organizing into something that looks like a body. And this becomes vivid if you think about the fact that 90 to 98% of your body's cells are not human cells, but bacteria. So you're sort of a cloud of human and non-human cells that are self-organizing into a human being. And the bacteria aren't living on your body. Without them, you would not have lived past the first days of birth. Those bacteria are necessary for the integrity and functioning of your human body. It gets more vivid when you think, well, how many objects have you touched in the room today, and other people have touched them, and so you're leaving bugs all over the place and other people are picking them up and you're transferring them all the time. It gets even more vivid when we now know that if you look in a household with more than one living being in it, you and another human, you and another human and or a non-human animal, which could be a dog, a cat, or a bird, the microbiome of each individual is actually part of a single microbiome, and the microbiome is a single self-organizing entity, which happens to have a few human, maybe dog, maybe cat, maybe parakeet islands within it. So at the cellular level, what's self and what's other? And if you go down, and that's what I refer to as complementarity, and that's kind of a way to think about emptiness of inherent existence. We are things at this level of scale, but at the next level of scale down, we are not things. We're phenomena arising from smaller things. And when you go down further, the boundary between you and something else extends outwards. So are cells an ultimate thing? Well, no, they're just biomolecules that are self-organizing. And so the cloud gets even bigger. Are those molecules a thing? No, they're just atoms. And those aren't things, they're just subatomic particles. And those aren't things, those are smaller subatomic particles. And now you're in the quantum realm, and we know because of quantum non-locality that there's no location. An electron is both a single point, but it's also an energy field that extends to the limits of the universe. So there is no inside and no outside. And when you go down to the layers below that, it's not an infinite regress. It stops at what's called the quantum vacuum. So that's the energy-rich, empty field out of which all existence arises. And because it's filled with energy, it gives energy equals mc squared, gives rise to matter, and it erupts into matter-antimatter pairings, and they self-annihilate, so there's this bubbling. That's why it's called the quantum foam. It's just sort of matter and then subsides, and matter and then it subsides. But every once in a while, some of that matter doesn't self-annihilate, and it self-organizes into subatomic particles, into atoms, into molecules, into cells, into the entire known universe. And my collaborator, Minas Kafatos, who's a cosmologist and a physicist and a Kashmiri Shaivist, and now dabbling in Buddhism in Korea, and I have put forth the idea, it's not an original idea, but it's an old idea that we're trying to sort of resurrect as scientifically concrete, that what that field of space-time that's energy-rich arises from is pure awareness. And that's what we're referring to in Buddhism as the absolute. It's the non-dual field of awareness that as it starts to become aware of itself, separating into self and other, duality, the moment you have separation, you have to have separation in space and in time. And so space-time leaps into existence. And we know from relativity that space-time inherently gives rise to energy and matter. And so the non-dual field of awareness that the Diamond Sutra is talking about gives rise to the world of objects, of duality that we experience as our normal daily thing. And these things are in complementarity too. The non-dual is in complementarity with duality. And so you can apprehend the absolute, but then you're missing the relative, which is an equal component. And if you apprehend the relative, which is the easy thing for all of us, then you're missing the absolute. So it's not one or the other. And I've often illustrated this when I've spoken in the Zendo and elsewhere as that sort of image where you have two faces looking at each other and the space between them looks like a vase. And so is it faces or is it a vase? Well, it's both, but you can't see both at the same time. You always have to make a choice. I'm seeing the vase, you lose the faces. You see the faces, you lose the vase. And so there's this incompleteness of any perspective, which also starts to sound like a Buddhist thing. Now, the thing that I'm seeing, this is the quickest I've ever explained this, and I don't know whether it will come across. So, two faces in a vase as a way of explaining complementarity. So is that the way non-duality is in complementarity with the world of phenomenon and things? Well, you could theoretically go back to the strip. The two sides of this loop of paper are in complementarity to each other. But the one side doesn't have to be aware of the other side. The one side doesn't turn into the other side. You could choose to only ever see the faces and never see the vase. Does the non-dual, could the non-dual simply remain non-dual and never give rise to the world of phenomena? But what if the complementarity is a Mobius strip? Then it's impossible for the non-dual not to erupt into our existence. And it turns out Manas and I are working with some other people on the mathematical expression of that process of non-duality becoming duality. And it turns out the math may describe a Mobius strip, so that it's absolutely necessary that the non-dual and duality are one and the same thing, just seen from different views. So the verse in the Blue Cliff Record on the koan gives us the way out. The first line of this gets me choked up. The clear jewel is in my palm. Whoever has accomplishment will be rewarded with it. When neither foreigner nor native comes, it has utterly no abilities. Since it has no abilities, the evil one loses the way. Gautama, Gautama, do you know me or not? What is the clear jewel? Yunmen, in another koan in the Blue Cliff Record, talks it about the jewel within the mountain of form. It's that ability, that diamond awareness, that even within the mountain of form, it is precisely always the non-dual, pure awareness, no self and other, no distinctions, no concepts, nothing to be scornfully reviled, nothing to perform a wicked act, because it's absolutely seamless. Kaku Hoshi's One Bright Pearl. What a title for describing an exceptionally messy, beautiful life. But in all of the mess he describes, I don't think he'd mind me saying that, is that one bright pearl, which is the whole mess. It's the whole catastrophe of everything we do. And so then, what of wicked ways and scornful revilement, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? This is the tool that the Buddha pointed to, gave us, to cut through suffering, to cut through all of that kind of suffering, to cut through all of those karmic events and karmic implications. And it's always right here. You know, it's just there in an open palm. When neither, I thought, you know, for today, when neither foreigner nor native comes. So I'll close with a verse. I've never closed with a verse before, but it's cheesy writing verses, Roshi. But this one came to me coming in on the train from the reunion. Speak not of native and foreigner, coming and going, birth and death. Gautama, Gautama, do you know me or not?